Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 30th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week has a bright, solid red background. Governor Ron DeSantis is strolling along in a blue suit with a red tie. In each hand, he's got, I don't know exactly what to call them. They're puppet sticks or marionette sticks with strings attached to them. And at the end of them, the strings are miniature people. They're flying around all over the place as DeSantis walks. The headline is Putting on a Show: What DeSantis Proved by Flying Migrants to Martha's Vineyard. That is our first main story. We'll start with that. DeSantis facing legal blowback over migrant flight. What happened? Florida Governor Ron DeSantis faced possible legal repercussions this week for flying some 50 asylum-seeking migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard in a political stunt. As the migrants filed a lawsuit and a U.S. attorney looked into possible crimes, DeSantis set off a political firestorm when two planes carrying the mostly Venezuelan migrants recruited for the journey from San Antonio landed unannounced in Martha's Vineyard, a Massachusetts island with a wealthy summer population. Local residents scrambled to care for the disoriented migrants, who said a woman named Perla offered to fly them to Boston and gave them flyers saying they'd be eligible for benefits including housing assistance, job training, and 8 months cash assistance. The stunt builds on an ongoing campaign by Republican Governors Greg Abbott of Texas and Doug Ducey of Arizona to bus tens of thousands of migrants to Democratic-run New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. to call attention to an influx at the border, which has seen a record 2 million arrests of undocumented immigrants this fiscal year. The class action lawsuit, filed by the Boston group Lawyers for Civil Rights, accuses DeSantis of using false promises of work, housing, and other assistance to lure migrants onto the plains in a premeditated, fraudulent, and illegal scheme. Bexar County Sheriff Javier Salazar, who has jurisdiction over San Antonio, opened an investigation into the scheme, which he said preyed upon legal asylum seekers for a photo op. Some Democrats called on the Justice Department to open an investigation, and Massachusetts U.S. Attorney General Rachel Rollins said her office was looking into whether the flight violated any laws. DeSantis was unbowed. He said northern officials who boast of presiding over immigrant sanctuaries were getting a taste of what border towns deal with every day. When that happens, he said, they all of a sudden go berserk. What the editorial said. DeSantis has engaged in a shameful political stunt, said the Boston Globe. Consider the level of moral depravity it takes to use desperate human beings as pawn in a game of immigration chess. The 2024 presidential contender tricked those powerless people just to pander to the viewers of Fox News, which had a camera crew awaiting their arrival. Fortunately, the good people of Martha's Vineyard responded swiftly and humanely, providing food, clothing, shelter, and translators until the migrants could be ferried off-island for resettlement elsewhere in the state. DeSantis deftly exposed liberal hypocrisy, said the New York Post, and the howls of outrage are telling. If a drop of 50 migrants constitutes a disaster, why aren't those pseudo-humanitarians affronted by the chaos in border towns like Eagle Pass, Texas, that have been crushed by wave after wave of migrants lured by President Biden's open-door border policies. That's the catastrophe. What the columnist said. Republicans have hit a new low, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. Without any actual policy ideas to offer before the midterms, they've turned to a stunt that ticks every box of modern fascist republicanism. It's built on lies, it trolls the libs, and it victimizes powerless, non-white people. Meanwhile, the whole point of DeSantis' gambit to call out liberal hypocrisy backfired when sympathetic islanders mobilized and met a crisis manufactured to embarrass them with decency and civic virtue. Maybe so, said Rich Lowry in National Review. But the point is that they had to pull out all the stops to deal with a small one-time event. Imagine if it was happening all the time, as it does in border communities. Liberal mayors are now getting a taste of that and reacting in desperation. That's because when lots of migrants arrive in communities and stay, they draw on government benefits and public services, including the schools. Politics aside, our immigration system is overwhelmed, said Farrah Stockman in the New York Times, and the asylum process is a big part of what's not working. Under a federal law passed in 1980, anyone who shows up at the border can file for asylum if they have a well-founded fear of being persecuted. Over the past 2 years, about 1 million asylum seekers from dysfunctional Central American nations, Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and other countries, have been allowed into the U.S. to await legal proceedings. With a backlog of some 660,000 asylum cases, migrants have every incentive to file for asylum, knowing that even if they are denied, it will buy them years. By making false promises to the migrants, DeSantis may have crossed into illegality, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. And to pay for the stunt, he may have misused state funds earmarked for transporting unauthorized aliens from Florida. The migrants were collected in Texas, and they were legal asylum seekers. DeSantis couldn't care less about the law or the people he cruelly exploited, because to boost his presidential ambitions, his primary focus is to feed a steady flow of chum to conservative media. Controversy of the week. Abortion. Why did Graham propose a national 15-week ban? For a seasoned Senate veteran like Lindsey Graham, this was quite a step on the old rake, said Jason Linkins in the New Republic. In recent months, the sheer scale of the voter backlash to the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade had worried Republicans frantically scrubbing pro-life rhetoric from their websites and trying to shift the national conversation away from abortion. But then South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham shocked members of his own party by introducing a bill that would ban abortion nationwide after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Graham's bill won't even get a vote in the Democratic-controlled Senate, said Aaron Gloria Ryan in the Daily Beast. All it achieves is ensuring that abortion stays in the headlines, while confirming Democratic warnings that with Roe gone, the GOP would push for a national ban. Understandably, most Senate Republicans, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, quickly distanced themselves from Graham and his bill. But if Republicans do end up snatching defeat from the jaws of victory in November, they'll know whose stupid politics to blame. Graham is no fool, said Rich Lowry in Politico. He understands that the GOP can either spend the next 2 months ducking and covering on abortion or plant its flag in a defensible position. While roughly two-thirds of voters support legal abortion in the first trimester, when 93% of U.S. abortions occur, a recent Harvard-Harris poll found that 72% of voters, including 60% of Democrats, don't think abortions should be permitted after 15 weeks. If Republicans are smart, they'll support Graham's legislation rather than surrender. As Graham pointed out, liberal nations such as France and Norway restrict abortion after only 12 weeks of pregnancy, said Kayleigh McGee White in the Washington Examiner. Can Republicans really not rally around a bill that would merely bring us in line with the rest of the civilized world? Graham's appeal to the European model was duplicitous, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. Those nations actually subsidize abortions and make them widely available so women can easily get them early in pregnancy. And their 12 to 15 week bans all have broad exceptions that allow for later abortions for such reasons as a woman's mental health or even financial hardship. Graham's bill, by contrast, very narrowly defines exceptions for the health of the mother, requires rapes to be reported to authorities, and would even force women to give birth to fetuses with severe abnormalities, which often aren't discovered until amniocentesis or other tests in the later stages of pregnancy. The cruelty of this is almost unfathomable. Let's be real, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian. Republicans' ultimate goal is a national ban on all abortions. When not panicked by midterm polling, they admit as much. And a bill like Graham's is a step toward that objective. Note that his supposed compromise bill wouldn't legalize abortions before 15 weeks. All those draconian red state laws would stay in effect. His plan is to crack down on blue states that want to let women, not right-wing male legislators, decide whether to terminate a pregnancy. Graham's politically boneheaded bill will go nowhere for now, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. But it's no longer hard to imagine a moment when Republicans have the power to proceed with a sweeping national ban on abortion and use it. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for stoners, with new British research suggesting that regular marijuana users are no more lazy or unmotivated than the general population. The belief that cannabis users are apathetic couch potatoes, researchers said, is itself a lazy stereotype. It was a good week for following the evidence. After customs officials at Germany's Dusseldorf airport found an 8-inch-long snail on an airport baggage truck and followed its slime trail to a sack containing 93 other giant snails being shipped from Nigeria for sale as meat. It was a good week for afternoon activities after a Taiwanese nursing home admitted it had hired an exotic dancer dressed in skimpy lingerie to entertain wheelchair-bound veterans. A spokesperson for the home said the staff had no idea the dancer would be so enthusiastic and fiery. But it was a bad week for tourism after Wu Zunyu, chief epidemiologist at the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, responded to China's first known case of monkeypox by urging citizens to exercise vigilance and avoid skin-to-skin contact with foreigners. It was a bad week for revising history after sharp-eyed subscribers noticed that HBO Max has digitally airbrushed cigarettes out of the posters for its classic movies, which left stars such as Warren Beatty and Paul Newman gesturing strangely at their mouths with empty fingers. And it was a bad week for neo-prohibition after the city of Philadelphia apologized for destroying the private hop garden of the Philadelphia Brewing Company in a city lot. The city blamed the raid on miscommunication and a staff error, explaining that it appeared the lot was overgrown. ¶¶ the briefing this week is titled Prosecuting the Insurrectionists. The Justice Department is racking up guilty pleas in the largest criminal investigation in U.S. history. Who's been prosecuted so far? Federal prosecutors have charged 910 people with participating in the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, including far-right militia members, cops, doctors, business owners, a State Department aide, a New Mexico County commissioner, an Olympic gold medalist, and at least 81 former or current members of the armed services and 19 current or former police officers. Some of the most prominent insurrectionists have already been sentenced, including Jacob Chansley, the face-painted, spear-carrying QAnon shaman, and Robert Packer, whose sweatshirt that day read, Camp Auschwitz. An estimated 2,500 people stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021, and attempts to identify the rioters continue. Prosecutors say about 2,000 of them could ultimately face charges. Most of the accused are white male supporters of former President Trump, who say they were radicalized by his claims of a stolen election and were acting in response to his command that they fight like hell to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory. At his trial, Dustin Thompson, a 38-year-old exterminator from Columbus, Ohio, said he believed that at Trump's January 6th Stop the Steal rally, the president had given an order to do something, and I felt obligated to do that. Are prosecutors getting convictions? Yes, although many cases remain pending. About 390 have pleaded guilty, and 34 were convicted at trial and sentenced. The average felony sentence has been about 33 months. Just one defendant has been acquitted of all charges. A former government contractor who persuaded a judge that police allowed him inside the Capitol. Albert Watkins, an attorney for several January 6 defendants, said guilty pleas were unavoidable given the selfies defendants took inside the Capitol. It's hard to defend somebody when there's roughly 287 million miles of video footage of your client being where he's not supposed to be, Watkins said. What crimes were charged? Hundreds of insurrectionists have been charged with trespassing, and another several hundred face charges of obstructing Congress certification of the Electoral College vote. About a dozen rioters have received more than a year in prison for assaulting police officers. Last week, Patrick McAfee, 25, was convicted of seven felonies for grabbing a riot shield and using it to pin D.C. police officer Daniel Hodges in a doorway. A video of the attack shows a crutch Hodges screaming in pain, and McAfee rips off his gas mask and beats the officer's head against the door. Are there any long sentences? A few. Retired New York City cop Thomas Webster was sentenced earlier this month to 10 years in prison. Webster wore a tactical vest to the Capitol and swung a metal flagpole at an officer before tackling the officer and pulling off his gas mask. Lonnie Leroy Kaufman, a 72-year-old military veteran, was sentenced to 46 months after parking a truck near the Capitol filled with Molotov cocktails, a handgun, a rifle, a shotgun, a crossbow, a stun gun, a machete, and 11 jars of homemade napalm. Guy Reffitt, a Texan militia member who prosecutors said lit the match of the insurrection, was sentenced to 7 years in prison after his own son alerted the FBI to his involvement. If you turn me in, Reffitt had told his son, you're a traitor. Traitors get shot. Cleveland Meredith received 28 months in prison for texting about plans to assassinate Pelosi by putting a bullet in her noggin on live TV. He was arrested a mile from the Capitol with a rifle, 2,500 rounds of ammunition. Are the charges sufficiently serious? That's been debated fiercely. Judge Beryl Howell challenged prosecutors for suggesting little to no jail time for many insurrectionists. No wonder parts of the public in the U.S. are confused about whether what happened on January 6th at the Capitol was simply a petty offense of trespassing with some disorderliness or shocking criminal conduct that represented a grave threat to our democratic norms, Howell said. Others have praised the DOJ for differentiating what former federal prosecutor Paul Rosenzweig called the idiots from the leaders. Earlier this year, prosecutors charged 16 leaders of the far-right Oath Keepers and Proud Boys with seditious conspiracy, which carries a sentence of up to 20 years in prison. Prosecutors have unearthed a 9-page document titled 1776 Returns, which appears to detail these white nativist groups' plans for patriots to storm government buildings. Are the attackers repentant? Some are, but others are not. I'm just so ashamed that I was part of that, said Florida business owner Robert Palmer after being sentenced to more than 5 years in prison for assaulting police. Another rioter, Stephen Ayers, urged Trumpists to take the blinders off before it's too late. But many attackers say they still believe the 2020 election was stolen. Before being sentenced to 44 months in prison for attacking an officer, Nicholas Langerand said in an online message, "In the face of tyranny, violence may be the only answer," adding, "Next time, we come back with rifles." And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Durham ends with a whimper. From the start, the probe was a red herring, said David Graham. In 2019, Attorney General Bill Barr appointed U.S. Attorney John Durham to investigate the origins of the FBI investigation into the 2016 Trump campaign's extensive ties with Russia. Barr and President Trump hoped Durham could prove that the investigation was a scandalous, deep state Democratic conspiracy against Trump. On the right, hopes were high that Durham would find damning proof of FBI perfidy because Trump's political con requires the promise of total vindication right around the corner. But after more than 3 years, Durham's inquiry is now wrapping up with little to show. The conviction of one FBI lawyer for fudging a warrant application. In stark contrast, Robert Mueller's team got 7 convictions or guilty pleas from Trump associates and documented more than 100 contacts between his campaign and Russians, including campaign manager Paul Manafort's secret dealings with a Russian agent. Though Trump escaped criminal charges, collusion happened. The point of Durham's investigation was to muddy that reality and to enable Trump and his allies to portray him as a victim. In that narrow sense, the Durham probe has served its purpose. What weed has wrought in California. When the weed wagon reaches your state, filled with false hopes and dubious promises of smoking one's way to prosperity, take a hard look at California, said the Washington Examiner. The state legalized recreational marijuana use by referendum in 2016, with advocates promising it would squeeze the illegal trade out of business. But as a Los Angeles Times investigation revealed last week, the exact opposite is happening now. It has spread crime out into the rural areas and turned local politics across the state into a morass of corruption. Local politicians are now demanding 6-figure bribes from the cannabis industry for growing licenses and legislative support. Meanwhile, as the use of weed becomes more widespread, illegal and completely unregulated growing operations have popped up across California, overwhelming local law enforcement. heavily armed camps filled with violent armed men, often tied to cartels, now dot the countryside. So much illegal marijuana is being grown and sold that cannabis prices are plunging, and the legal trade is now threatened. So before more states vote to legalize recreational weed, people need to be warned about what the marijuana legalization craze has done in California. The real value of college. Are the U.S. News and World Report college rankings a joke? Asked Michael Itkowitz. The 2022 rankings came out last week amid the scandalous news that Columbia University, number two in 2021's list, had fallen to the 18th spot following accusations that administrators had submitted doctored data. Does the drop in rank mean Columbia is no longer as good a school as schools higher on the list? That depends on how you define a good education. With endowments of billions of dollars and tuitions of upwards of $70,000 a year, elite private colleges mostly educate children of already wealthy families and do more to reinforce socioeconomic inequality than to mitigate it. Fortunately, there are hundreds of fine colleges, both public and private, that fulfill a more essential role, to give working and middle-class students the necessary skills to compete in today's workforce and leave them better off than their parents. Social mobility is the foundation of the American dream. If the purpose of higher education is to lift the next generation up, let's stop focusing on elite universities and recognize and reward those that truly deliver on that promise. This column is from Australia. Why we don't really need King Charles. With the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, Australia now has a new head of state in King Charles, said Jeffrey Robertson. But why exactly? Most of us had affection for his mother, but Australia has changed a great deal over the 70 years of her reign. Charles, after all, is king only by virtue of his descent from a 17th century German princess, not a particularly fitting symbol for an increasingly diverse Australia. What is the point of stamping his face on our coins? And why have a Royal Australian Navy when it serves not London, but Canberra? The last time we had a chance to weigh in on the issue, in a 1999 referendum, a majority of Australians did in fact want to dump the monarchy. They only voted down the referendum because it proposed a head of state appointed by politicians rather than elected by the people. It didn't occur to us to ask whether we need a head of state separate from our prime minister as head of a government at all, royal or not. I'd say no. All the current one does is ribbon cuttings and the like, duties that could be allocated to distinguished Australians or community leaders or underemployed state governors. Let's dump the head of state position altogether. We could gain a new sense of national pride. The last word, our feature article, titled this week, Democracy in Peril. Republicans are wielding disproportionate power with a minority of the popular vote, said David Lenhart in the New York Times, and many of them now reject any loss as illegitimate. The United States has experienced deep political turmoil several times before over the past century. The Great Depression caused Americans to doubt the country's economic system. World War II and the Cold War presented threats from global totalitarian movements. The 1960s and 70s were marred by assassinations, riots, a losing war, and a disgraced president. These earlier periods were each more alarming in some ways than anything that has happened in the United States recently. Yet during each of those previous times of tumult, the basic dynamics of American democracy held firm. Candidates who won the most votes were able to take power and attempt to address the country's problems. The current period is different. As a result, the United States finds itself in a situation with little historical precedent. American democracy is facing two distinct threats, which together represent the most serious challenge to the country's governing ideals in decades. The first threat is acute. A growing movement inside one of the country's two major parties, the Republican Party, to refuse to accept defeat in an election. The violent January 6, 2021 attack on Congress, meant to prevent the certification of President Joe Biden's election, was the clearest manifestation of this movement. But it has continued since then. Hundreds of elected Republican officials around the country falsely claim that the 2020 election was rigged. Some of them are running for statewide offices that would oversee future elections. There is the possibility, for the first time in American history, that a legitimately elected president will not be able to take office, said Yasha Monk, a political scientist at Johns Hopkins University who studies democracy. The second threat to democracy is chronic, but also growing. The power to set government policy is becoming increasingly disconnected from public opinion. The run of recent Supreme Court decisions, both sweeping and, according to polls, unpopular, highlights this disconnect. Although the Democratic Party has won the popular vote in seven of the past eight presidential elections, a Supreme Court dominated by Republican appointees seems poised to shape American politics for years, if not decades. And the court is only one of the means through which policy outcomes are becoming less closely tied to the popular will. Two of the past four presidents have taken office despite losing the popular vote. Senators representing a majority of Americans are often unable to pass bills, partly because of the increasing use of the filibuster. Even the House, intended as the branch of the government that most reflects the popular will, does not always do so, because of the way districts are drawn. We are far and away the most counter-majoritarian democracy in the world, said Stephen Levitsky, a professor of government at Harvard University, and a co-author of the book How Democracies Die, with Daniel Ziblatt. The founders did not design the United States to be a pure democracy. They distrusted the classical notion of direct democracy, in which a community came together to vote on each important issue, and believed it would be impractical for a large country. They did not consider many residents of the new country to be citizens who deserved a voice in political affairs, including natives, enslaved Africans, and women. The founders also wanted to constrain the national government from being too powerful, as they believed was the case in Britain. Instead of a direct democracy, the founders created a republic with elected representatives to make decisions and a multi-layered government in which different branches checked one another. The Constitution also created the Senate, where every state had an equal say, regardless of the population. But the historical evidence suggests that the founders believed that majority will, defined as the prevailing view of enfranchised citizens, should generally dictate national policy. Before 2000, only three candidates won the presidency while losing the popular vote. During the same period, parties that won repeated elections were able to govern, including the Democratic-Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson's time, the New Deal Democrats, and the Reagan Republicans. The situation has changed in the 21st century. The Democratic Party is in the midst of a historic winning streak. In seven of the past eight presidential elections, stretching back to 1992, the Democratic nominee has won the popular vote. Yet the current period is hardly a dominant democratic age. What changed? One crucial factor is that in the past, the parts of the country granted outsized power by the Constitution, less populated states, which tend to be more rural, voted in broadly similar ways as large states and urban areas. The similarity meant that the small state bonus in the Senate and Electoral College had only a limited effect on national results. Both Democrats and Republicans benefited and suffered from the Constitution's undemocratic features. In recent decades, though, Americans have increasingly sorted themselves along ideological lines. Liberals have flocked to large metropolitan areas, which are heavily concentrated in big states like California, while residents of smaller cities and more rural areas have become more conservative. The combination of the Constitution's structure and the country's geographic sorting has created a disconnect between public opinion and election outcomes. It has affected every branch of the federal government, the presidency, Congress, and even the Supreme Court. In presidential elections, the small state bias is important, but it is not even the main issue. A subtler factor, the winner-take-all nature of the Electoral College in most states, is. Today, Democrats dominate a handful of large states. This shift means that millions of voters in large metropolitan areas have moved away from the Republican Party without having any impact on presidential outcomes. That's a central reason that both George W. Bush and Donald Trump were able to win the presidency while losing the popular vote. While liberals have sorted themselves into large metropolitan areas and conservatives into more rural areas, large states have grown much more quickly than small states. Today, California has 68 times as many residents as Wyoming. Together, these trends mean that the Senate has a heavily pro-Republican bias that will last for the foreseeable future. The Senate today is split 50-50 between the two parties, but the 50 Democratic senators effectively represent 186 million Americans, while the 50 Republican senators effectively represent 145 million. To win Senate control, Democrats need to win substantially more than half of the nationwide votes in Senate elections. The House of Representatives has a more equitable system for allocating political power. It divides the country into 435 districts, each with a broadly similar number of people, currently about 760,000. Still, House districts have two features that can cause the chamber's makeup not to reflect national opinion, and both of them have become more significant in recent years. The first is well known, gerrymandering. State legislatures often draw district boundaries and in recent years have become more aggressive about drawing them in partisan ways. But gerrymandering is not the only reason that House membership has become less reflective of national opinion in recent years, and may not even be the biggest. The increasing concentration of Democratic voters into large metro areas means that even a neutral system would have a hard time distributing these tightly packed Democratic voters across districts in a way that it would allow the party to win more elections. Instead, Democrats now win many House elections in urban areas by landslides, wasting many votes. In 2020, only 21 Republican House candidates won their elections by at least 50 percentage points. 47 Democrats did. Again and again, geographic sorting has helped cause a growing disconnect between public opinion and election results. And this disconnect has shaped the Supreme Court as well. The court's membership at any given time is dictated by the outcomes of presidential and Senate elections over the previous few decades. And if elections reflected popular opinion, Democratic appointees would dominate the court. Yet the court is now dominated by a 6-member conservative majority. The current court's approach has magnified the disconnect between public opinion and government policy because Republican-appointed justices have overruled Congress on some major issues. The list includes bills on voting rights and campaign finance that earlier Congresses passed along bipartisan lines. This term, the court issued rulings on abortion, climate policy, and gun laws that seemed to be inconsistent with majority opinion based on polls. If the only challenges to democracy involved these chronic long-developing forces, many experts would be less concerned than they are. American democracy has always been flawed, after all. But the slow-building ways in which majority rule is being undermined are happening at the same time that the country faces an immediate threat that has little precedent. A growing number of Republican officials are questioning a basic premise of democracy, that the losers of an election are willing to accept defeat. Trump's embrace of election fraud lies was starkly different from the approach of past leaders from both parties. In the 1960s, Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater ultimately isolated the far-right conspiracist of the John Birch Society. In 2000, Al Gore urged his supporters to accept George W. Bush's razor-thin victory, much as Richard Nixon had encouraged his supporters to do so after he narrowly lost to John F. Kennedy in 1960. Trump's promotion of falsehoods, by contrast, turned them into a central part of the Republican Party's message. About two-thirds of Republican voters say that Biden did not win the 2020 election legitimately, according to polls. Most Republican politicians who have confronted Trump have since lost their jobs or soon will. Of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach him for his role in the January 6 attack, 8 have since decided to retire or lost Republican primaries. In 11 states this year, the Republican nominee for Secretary of State, a position that typically oversees election administration, qualifies as an election denier, according to State United Action, a research group. In 15 states, the nominee for governor is a denier, and in 10 states, the Attorney General nominee is. The growth of the election denier movement has created a possibility that would have seemed unthinkable not so long ago. It remains unclear whether the loser of the next presidential election will concede or will instead try to overturn the outcome. It's not clear how the crisis is going to manifest itself, but there is a crisis coming, Levitsky said. Over the sweep of history, the American government has tended to become more democratic through women's suffrage, civil rights laws, the direct election of senators, and more. The exceptions, like the post-Reconstruction period, when black Southerners lost rights, have been rare. The current period is so striking partly because it is one of those exceptions. The point is not that American democracy is worse than it was in the past, Monk said. Throughout American history, the exclusion of minority groups, and African Americans in particular, was much worse than it is now. But the nature of the threat is very different than in the past, he said. The makeup of the federal government reflects public opinion less closely than it once did, and the chance of a true constitutional crisis, in which the rightful winner of an election cannot take office, has risen substantially. That combination shows that American democracy has never faced a threat quite like the current one. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. We're on the health and science page. Start with making oxygen on Mars. In a major step toward human exploration of Mars, NASA scientists have successfully produced oxygen on the Red Planet. The breakthrough is the work of Mars Oxygen In Situ Resource Utilization Experiment, MOXIE for short. A toaster-sized gadget attached to the Perseverance rover. The gold-plated device sucks in Martian atmosphere, which is almost entirely carbon dioxide, and splits off the oxygen atoms. It has produced oxygen for an hour each of the seven times it has been used. Sourcing the gas in situ is vital because shipping it all the way from Earth would be prohibitively expensive. And oxygen would be needed for more than just breathing. It could be combined with other compounds to make rocket fuel. We have to be able to live off the land, NASA's Jennifer Haldeman tells The Atlantic. This is the first time that we've been able to test and demonstrate the technology to do that. Still, making oxygen on Mars is not easy. The atmosphere is so thin, it's practically a vacuum. Temperatures can vary by more than 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and the air becomes much denser at night, all factors that can affect carbon dioxide levels. But if MOXIE can be successfully scaled up, it currently produces about enough oxygen to sustain a cat, it will remove a major barrier to interplanetary travel. Elk return to Virginia. More than 150 years after they were driven out by overhunting and habitat destruction, elk are once again thriving in Virginia. Generally associated these days with the western U.S. and Canada, elk were common all across eastern North America as well until the late 1800s, though they were last seen in Virginia in the 1850s. Now, 10 years after wildlife officials reintroduced them, more than 250 of the large lumbering bovines roam the southwest of the state. Experts say the best time to see them is early mornings or evenings between late August and October, when they are focused on mating and less likely to be spooked by the presence of humans. A male elk, known as a bull, can have antlers that reach 4 feet above its head. To attract a female, he emits a surprisingly high-pitched piercing call. When you hear that bugling, it's the most wild sound ever. Jackie Rosenberger from the Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources tells the Washington Post, it's a wildlife success story. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page, starting with an article titled, Star, the Clinton Inquisitor's Legacy. Kenneth Starr, who died last week, left an indelible mark on U.S. politics, said David Greenberg in Politico, and a regrettable one. Starr was the independent counsel who in the 1990s led a years-long investigation of then-President Bill Clinton, turning what began as a dead-end inquiry into an Arkansas real estate deal into a frenzied political inquisition. Starr, a partisan Christian conservative whose colorless exterior masked an inner zeal, decided to target Clinton's sexual dalliance with a White House intern, Monica Lewinsky. The inquisition that followed was a sordid disgrace, with Starr and his staff, including future Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, issuing a lurid, nearly pornographic report full of gratuitous descriptions of specific sex acts that humiliated Lewinsky. Impeached for lying about the affair, Clinton was acquitted by the Senate. But the disruption to the country had been enormous. With his moralistic, scorched-earth effort to take down a political foe, Starr helped poison the atmosphere in Washington. Actually, Starr was an eminently decent man who served his nation honorably, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. Yes, Starr may have overshot his mark in pursuit of Clinton, but he was genuinely offended by the transgressions against the law, duty, and normative ethics. The reward for his diligence was to be unfairly vilified by Democrats, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Those upset about the tawdry details he revealed should blame Clinton, not the public servant who brought them to light. Starr's moral rectitude proved to have plenty of blind spots, said Christopher Hooks in Texas Monthly. In 2007, he leveraged his political connections to help the serial sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein obtain a shockingly lenient secret plea deal, despite evidence he sexually abused scores of teenage girls. In 2016, he was fired as president of Baylor University after his administration buried numerous reports of rapes by football players. A longtime advisor, Judy Hirschman, came forward in 2021 to say Starr initiated their own affair, an allegation he never denied. Starr's moral relativism was on further display when he defended Donald Trump at his first impeachment trial, while lamenting, without irony, our age of impeachment. In the end, if Starr's life contains one lesson for the rest of us, it is a reminder that right and righteous are different things. Trump using QAnon to threaten violence. After years of playing footsie with QAnon, former President Trump has begun openly embracing it, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. At a 6,000-person rally last week in Youngstown, Ohio, for GOP Senate candidate J.D. Vance, Trump delivered an especially dark rant about how Joe Biden and the Democrats are destroying America and paving the way for World War III. This time, however, a spooky melody played in the background, an instrumental that serves as an anthem for the right-wing conspiracy theory whose slogan is, "Where we go one, we go all." In a deeply disturbing response that evoked Hitler's Nazi rallies, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast, crowd members raised outstretched arms and index fingers in an apparent reference to one. Days earlier, Trump reposted a picture of himself on his social media platform, Truth Social, wearing a Q pin with a Q meme. "The storm is coming," a reference to the cult's prophecy of Trump's final victory when he regains power and his enemies are rounded up and executed on live TV. Some of the January 6 insurrectionists were QAnon followers who believe the storm had arrived, said Zishan Alim in MSNBC.com. Belief in Q has reportedly driven several Americans to commit murder, including a Michigan man who last week allegedly shot his wife dead and severely injured their daughter after becoming obsessed with QAnon. Trump's overt embrace of this cult signals how panicked he is, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. With multiple investigations placing him in rising legal jeopardy, he's weaponizing the Q mob as a threat to sow violence if he's prosecuted. "I didn't think American politics could get much darker, but here we are." Make no mistake about where Trump is taking us, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. At Youngstown, the mass, zombie-like right-arm obedience to America's wannabe dictator rekindled chilling memories of Nuremberg rallies, and his increasingly fascistic tone is not solely a Donald Trump problem. A host of GOP elected officials and candidates are pandering to Q-driven claims that Democrats are pedophiles and groomers, making dehumanizing attacks on immigrants and LGBTQ people, and calling for America to become a conservative Christian theocracy. A fascistic virus has infected most of the Republican Party, and the American experiment itself is up for grabs. Read some of the short notes now. Here, a real short one. Less than 8% of the world's population live under a monarchy, down from more than a third in 1950. A great-great-grandmother of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was an illiterate immigrant from Italy who would have been barred from entering the U.S. if she'd arrived 3 months later. Lucia Colucci arrived at Ellis Island on February 21, 1917, pregnant and with two teenage daughters, In May of that year, a law aimed at stanching the flow of undesirable immigrants went into effect that barred illiterate people from being admitted to the U.S. The number of Americans identifying as Christian dropped from approximately 90% 3 decades ago to 64% in 2020, according to a new Pew Research Center project. Americans with no religious affiliation soared from 16% in 2007 to 29% in 2020. In response to a question, 12 Republican candidates for governor and the Senate either would not commit to accepting the election results in November or declined to provide an answer. All of the Democrats in those races said they would accept the results. And then Poll Watch, 66% of Americans support Ukraine's attempts to reclaim lost territory, even if it results in prolonged conflict. 31% want the fighting to end quickly, even if it means ceding territory to Russia. And we'll close with a quote from Queen Elizabeth II, who said, "Grief is the price we pay for love." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.